Dear everyone, warmest welcome. Thank you so much for being with us today. This is the third in the series of our online seminar in 2024. Now it's our great pleasure to introduce our esteemed speaker, Angela Jaffrey. Many of us are familiar with Angela through her works on the Sheikh Al-Akbar Mohideen Ibn Arabi. Her numerous articles and podcasts on Ibn Arabi are publicly available on the Mohideen Ibn Arabi Society's website. She has extensively written, translated, and provided commentary on various aspects of Ibn Arabi's works, and her efforts have significantly broadened access to Ibn Arabi's writings for contemporary students worldwide, enhancing our understanding of these profound texts. Angela earned her PhD in medieval Islamic philosophy from Harvard University. However, it is another path to which she has devoted her life. And among her notable translations are the book The Universal Tree and the Four Birds, published by Anka Publications in 2007. And another one, The Secrets of Voyaging, published by Anka Publications in 2015. These translations bring significant treatises to an English-speaking audience for the first time, complete with the new editions of the Arabic texts, insightful introductions, and extensive notes. Currently, Angela is working on a revised translation and commentary of a great mystic and teacher from the 10th century CE, Muhammad ibn Abdul Jabbar al-Nifari, and she is And this is definitely keenly anticipated, as the earlier English translation by A.J. Aubrey back in 1934 and then reprinted in 1978 as the Book of Spiritual Sayings and Spiritual Addresses are known to many of you. So currently, Angela is, so the books in Arabic is called the Mawakif and Mukhatabat. Today, Angela will share with us insights from various texts written at different stages of the Sheikh Al-Akbar's life and focusing on the significant role of the Prophet Aaron alayhi salam. So without further ado, please join me in warmly welcoming Angela Jaffrey.
I want to thank Chris. Your introduction was just overwhelming and so kind. And I'm really honored to be here today and to see so many of you. All my friends are here. It's really very encouraging. I want to start the way I sometimes start my talks, with a little pop quiz. Most, if not all of you, surely know who played Moses and Pharaoh in Cecil B. DeMille's 1956 biblical extravaganza, The Ten Commandments. But I ask you, as someone who had to look this up on Google, who played Aaron? Now, I can't see all of you, and I don't know if any of you have the answer to this. If you do, oh my goodness, I would be so impressed, but I'm going to assume that you don't have the answer. If you do, well, good for you. For those of you who can't bring to mind any image of Aaron from that movie or from any of the earlier or later ones, the answer, John Carradine as Aaron. And some of the later ones are these folks here. You may recognize some of them from movies you might have seen. I think probably a lot of people have seen the Prince of Egypt cartoon one. That's the most recent, I believe. So anyway, Aaron in these films usually plays almost no part. And when he is portrayed, especially in the older ones, the Cecil B. DeMille ones, certainly, he's portrayed as a kind of pathetic, weak character, overshadowed by his brother and humiliated at the end as the designer and artisan of the who is responsible for the sin of the calf. He does slightly better in the more recent versions, but he's definitely not the star of the show. Now, what I want to do today is to remedy this caricature of Aaron And also, I hope that by presenting the somewhat overlooked prophet, that more of you will be inspired to look at others of his ilk, such as Jonah and Job and Ezra. That's my image of AI-generated Aaron. This is my first AI experiment, and so you can look at him for a few minutes. In my initial reading of the Fusus al-Hikam, actually the second, since my first reading was in the English translation from the French, which skipped a chapter on Aaron altogether, the chapter entitled in the Austin translation, Religious Leadership, Imamiyah in the Word of Aaron, never attracted me with the same force as the chapters on Moses and Jesus and Muhammad, for example. Aaron seemed like a peripheral character at best, and the idea of religious leadership also failed to elicit much enthusiasm from me, giving rise to a picture of perhaps Imam Khomeini or maybe Jerry Falwell, overshadowed by his younger brother, Moses, maligned for his role in the Golden Calf saga. He didn't seem to be very impressive. It was only later, when engaging once more with the Fusus, and especially Bosnavi's commentary, affectionately known as the White Fusus, I was amazed at the fascinating material that could be found in this chapter, a notion of imamiyah that went far beyond my limited understanding of it, a discussion of superlative mercy. The unusual term rahamut intrigued me, and I began to have a real admiration for this paradoxical prophet. I began to explore various texts in which Aaron makes an appearance in the Sheikh al-Akbar's works, and to single out a plethora of themes that he treats in connection with this prophet. I discovered paradoxes galore, controversial themes explored, subtle threads connecting him to other prophets, and even some letter and number speculation to whet my appetite. We're not going to be able to cover the many facets of Aaron that arise when reading the Sheikh al-Akbar's various accounts. So, beginning with a brief synopsis of the narrative as found chiefly in the Quran, but supplemented by some radical differences encountered in the Bible, we will single out a few of the salient topics that the Sheikh brings to our attention. To begin, let me lay out the basic story of Aaron, Harun, slide 5, there's Harun, from biblical and Quranic sources. I promise to make this brief, since most of you probably are well acquainted with either or both of these narratives. Aaron is mentioned a grand total of 20 times in the Quran, and many more times in the Bible. In almost every case, Aaron is conjoined with his brother, Moses and Aaron, with Moses' name almost always preceding Aaron's. In the Quran, there's only one case where Aaron's name comes first. That is when the Pharaoh's magicians invoke the god of Aaron and Moses. Could it be that they find him a more relatable subject? Aaron is the older brother of Moses, greater in age, but Moses is greater in prophethood, because of the greatness of his message. As we discover in the Fusus chapter on Moses, Moses has been singled out and born with a special destiny, absorbing the spirits of all the male Israelite babies killed by Pharaoh in an attempt to avert his destiny, then ironically raised in the palace of Pharaoh himself. He is even named by the Pharaoh. Aaron, on the other hand, is raised among the Israelite community. The contrast between the brothers is not only in terms of older, younger, lower, higher in rank, but also in terms of personality. Our first encounter with Aaron is not in person, but through a conversation that God has with Moses at the burning bush, the transcendent deity manifesting in the immanental form of fire. God commands Moses to deliver a message to Pharaoh to let my people go. Moses argues repeatedly and prolongedly with God. Some commentaries claim 7 days, that he can't do it. For some reason or other, Moses has some sort of physical defect that we know about, or some kind of knot of his tongue. He claims that he has a straightened breast. Aaron is the more eloquent one, Afsah al-Lisan. The commentator Basnavi has a rhyming contrast between the two. Aaron is fasih and eloquent, and Moses is fadih. it has various meanings. They're very negative. I'll just translate it as coarse of speech. So it's Aaron's pleasing voice, gentle and penetrating, that is needed to deliver the message of liberation to Pharaoh. The two, therefore, produce a joint assault, a gentle assault, commanded by God to penetrate the resistance of Pharaoh. As we may recall from the movie, The Ten Commandments, if not from the Bible itself, dramatic push and pull occurs between the brothers and Pharaoh. Agreeing, then disagreeing, Pharaoh balks at allowing the Israelites to depart. Plagues are produced to get him to change his mind. Although the biblical series of plagues cannot be found in the Quran, in the book of Exodus, the symbolic staff or rod of authority is alternately wielded by Moses and Aaron to inflict these plagues. Aaron's rod, most notably, producing the plague that turns the Nile to bright red blood. The Quran account downplays Aaron's role in all of this. For someone noted for his eloquence, he is strangely silent. We don't see him arguing with Pharaoh. Instead, it is the newly articulate Moses who outmaneuvers Pharaoh's sophistical arguments. This does not seem to be the case in the Torah, where God instructs Moses to have Aaron speak to Pharaoh. The next time we encounter Aaron in the Quran is as Moses' vice-regent, Khalifa, or minister, wazir, specifically appointed as such by Moses, as Moses ascends the mount to receive the tablets of the law. While Moses is absent for 40 days, speaking face-to-face with God, or even mouth-to-mouth, pe al pe, as is said in Hebrew, the community splits into factions. Some decline to worship at all until Moses' return, but some, influenced by a mysterious figure known as Isamiri, desire to worship the Lord in the form of a calf. Aaron, though not directly responsible but seeking to preserve peace, yields to their demand. The calf is molded from the various jewels and treasures taken from Egypt, and a wild, sometimes described as orgiastic, rite ensues. When Moses comes down the mountain, he grabs Aaron by the beard and hair, reproaches him in front of the community, and throws down the tablets. Aaron notably appeals to their common mother, addressing Moses as son of my mother, Ibn Ummi. The appeal to their mother implies that they are blood brothers, brothers of the womb, the rahim, but they are also milk brothers, not only because they were both suckled by the same mother, but also because they are brothers in believing in one God. Thus, the appeal is both to Rahim, womb, and to Rahma, mercy, the first being a particular shared womb, the second, the universal mercy that has brought everything that is into existence. When Moses' eye lights upon the broken tablets, the words he sees are mercy and guidance. The brothers ask for forgiveness from their Lord and are forgiven. In subsequent developments, chiefly found in the Bible rather than in the Quran, the brothers guide the Israelites in their long trek through the desert in search of a promised land, a land which none of the first generation lives to enter. Aaron and his tribe, the Levites, are chosen through the miraculous flowering of his rod into almond blossoms over the other 11 tribes of Israel to serve as high priests of the tabernacle, later of the temple in Jerusalem. He is given a priestly robe and a breastplate embellished with 12 precious stones to represent the 12 tribes of Israel. Moses, exhibiting his characteristic impetuosity and anger, uses his rod to strike a rock to produce water rather than to speak to it gently. For this, both he and Aaron are reproached by God and given the severe punishment of being forbidden to enter the Holy Land. Both must die in exile. Aaron's death precedes that of Moses, and in a beautiful death scene, the two, along with Aaron's son Eleazar, climb Mount Hor, where Aaron is divested of his priestly garments and dies. Moses dies later, alone, but with a kiss of God. Moses' tomb is unknown. Aaron's tomb can still be visited. on Jabal Harun in Petra, Jordan. This is a trek that I recommend to everyone. If you go to Petra, hike up there, you'll get a view that you will not believe. Okay, now turning this to the Sheikh al-Akbar. It is a well-known characteristic of the Sheikh al-Akbar that he rarely, ever, presents the sum total of what he has received on any subject in a single text. Specific aspects are displayed in various works, often in a single work. The Akbarian researcher must then become a kind of archaeologist, or better yet, a treasure seeker, trekking from site to site in search of the pieces that may or may not fit together to form a coherent picture of any given theme or person. This frustratingly fragmentary style is not the process of a disordered mind, God forbid. It was a purposeful and evocative teaching tool. We have to work at it, and we have to humbly seek guidance. A word or image deemed significant may set us out on a trekking expedition, which may or may not yield results. And in the end, the puzzle will remain incomplete, since there is never any end to the search for real knowledge. We will now give a synopsis of the Aaronic themes touched on in a number of these works before singling out a few passages to discuss. Husus al-Hikam. Aaron's word here is imamia, as we've seen, religious leadership, and his outstanding attribute is rachamut, superlative mercy. Themes dealt with are submission and hierarchy, and how lower and higher are in turn submitted to each other. Proper worship that calls for taking into account both the transcendent in the immanent and the immanent in the transcendent. The double-edged sword of Hawa, a form of love connected with passion, is discussed here in a way that is not emphasized elsewhere. The Futuhat al-Makkiyah. There are many references to Aaron and the questions he elicits in the Futuhat, too many to mention here. I will give you only a tiny glimpse of some of the more provocative ones. There are many more. Chapter 2's alphabet poem of Dodd, Moses' letter, and Lamb, Aaron's letter. It is particularly puzzling why Moses' Dodd poem, with its reference to Rahamut and Imam, applies more to Aaron than to Moses. We won't have time to discuss this today, but it is something to investigate further, and those interested should see Hertenstein and Benito's Patterns of Contemplation, where this poem is translated and discussed. Chapter 178, The Alchemy of Happiness. This is where you get out your fire extinguishers. This concerns two spiritual travelers, follower of a divinely inspired teacher and a theoretical philosopher, who ascends through the celestial spheres in pursuit of knowledge. After learning, to the best of their capacity, from Adam, Jesus, Joseph, and Idris, they reach the threshold of the red planet, Al-Ahmar, Mars, where the prophet Aaron is said to dwell. Almost immediately, a disjunction appears between the character of the red planet, which is associated with violence, war, murder, in short, bloodshed of every kind, and the prophet Aaron, who greets the travelers with generous hospitality and effusive welcome. The red planet is shocked, as are we, if we too expect Aaron to exhibit these planetary characteristics when he meets his guests. Furthermore, from all the stories we have heard about Aaron, we know his character to be of the gentlest sort. He is the epitome of Jamal, beauty, both inside and out. What, do we ask, does he have to do with bloodshed and violence? We could say much more about the planet Mars, including its more benign side. I recently discovered that Dante, the great Italian poet, connects Mars to the liberal art of music, since both bring together elements of harmony and discord. Much attention is given in this section to Pharaoh, taking up the theme of Zahir and Batin in relation to his character. We will encounter again these two attributes when speaking of Moses and Aaron, but here the discussion is focused on Pharaoh as an example of someone whose exterior, like Moses', is Jalal, but whose interior is shockingly Jamal. In concluding the section, the Sheikh remarks that this particular heaven requires bloodshed. and that through animal sacrifice, which Aaron as high priest is charged with, animals may attain the degree of human. We are reminded here of the Fasus chapter on Isaac. Chapter 198. The breath of the all-compassionate. This chapter provides us with a spectrum of creation as the breath of compassion descends through the levels from the highest of the high to the lowest of the low, and then gives a hint of return. Each level of existence is assigned a divine name, an Arabic letter stemming from the most inner and unvoiced to the most outward and most audible, a mansion of the moon, and where appropriate, a prophet. We have also been guided by luminaries such as Michel Shodkiewicz and Abdul Hadi Miftah to find the correspondences between the sections belonging to this chapter and the chapters of the Fasus. With Aaron, we have two opportunities to find associations, since he is placed by name in the level pertaining to the planet Mars, but again at the level of the animals, since his Fasus chapter, chapter 24, corresponds to levels 34 of chapter 198. The breath of the all-compassionate, when it turns to face the particular levels devoted to Aaron, brings into existence these notable aspects. In terms of divine names, in section 23, it brings into existence the level of Mars, the name Al-Kahir, the subduer, whose mandate includes violence and spilling of blood, the voiced letter Lam, which as a preposition subjects what follows it to a state of brokenness, indicated by the small vowel under the word it governs, and the moon mansion Al-Awa, the howler. As for section 34, which is the level of the animals, the divine name associated with it is Al-Muzil. Al-Muzil, the letter which means the abaser or the lower, the letter connected with it is Zal, over there on the left side, which in itself means low, and the moon mansion, Sa'ad Asud, the fortune of the fortunate. The paradoxical theme of fortune within abasement is alluded to by these words of the Sheikh. Of the names providing universal amelioration of the universe, there is none like this name Muzil, and none who have its rule in the divine presence. Its effective rule is forever in this world and the next. If the real erects lowliness in some of the Gnostics in their visions of him and manifests radiantly to them, in them, and from them, there will be no servants of God more with God than them, and there is no one more knowledgeable than they are about the mysteries of God disclosed in unveiling. Chapter 378 of the Futuhat. This is a mirage chapter in which the Sheikh Al-Akbar spiritually ascends to ask the various prophets certain questions that perplex him. In the case of Aaron, one thing that puzzles the Sheikh is how, despite his lofty station as vice-regent, prophet, and messenger, yes, messenger in a certain sense, he fears the power of the enemies among his people. How can he be like this when there are Gnostics who claim that for them, existence of the world becomes non-existent, that they see nothing but God, and nothing distracts them from him? Does this not imply that these Gnostics have a higher status than Aaron? Aaron then asks the Sheikh, in turn, if the annihilation these Gnostics taste actually result in the disappearance of the cosmos. The answer is, of course, no. Aaron explains that to the extent that they are annihilated from the world, they are lacking in complete knowledge of the real, since they have become veiled from it. The cosmos, all of it, he says, is the self-manifestation, tajali, of the real, for whoever really knows the real. Chapter 559 of the Futuhat. This is a bizarre chapter, summarizing all the Futuhat's chapters, not always in sync with the material covered. Here we find lovely discussions of hawa, desire, which, as we've noted, is a principal concern of the Aaron chapter in the Fasus al-Hikam. The Isfar, the voyages of the prophet. Note that these are the voyages of Moses, not the voyages of Moses and Aaron. Moses has, in a way, swallowed up Aaron like his serpent staff swallows up the serpents of the magicians. It deals with Aaron as he is left behind as Moses' Khalifa at the foot of Mount Tur, but then goes into more detail regarding the role the Samiri plays in the story. The Isra, the night journey. In it, the Sheikh visits the red planet, here called Ashurta, the guard, a name suggesting signs, conditions, and even base animals marked off for slaughter. Aaron here is seen as a magnificent personage, a vice-regent surrounded by courtiers, treated with the utmost of respect. Despite his grandeur in this station, he is credited with humbly drinking the cup of disgrace, an allusion to the rough treatment by his brother, and of meekly standing in Moses' shadow while maintaining his inner dignity. His vizier makes reference in verse to his subtle leadership of the community. He governed the people, but his governance was not apparent, while all could see the calf and the idol. He never ceased calling to the few who continue to seek what Moses obtained. They do not know that the way is forbidden, for whenever eyesight sees a thing, its essence turns to nothingness. Tuesday, prayers in the Aurad. Now, don't expect to be able to read this. It's very small print. I merely wanted to point out that the evening prayer uses extremely forceful language and Quranic references, beginning with, "You are the most forceful in assault, the most painful in seizing, the most tremendous in conquering." The prayer also mentions the letter Lam, which, as we've seen, is the letter associated with Aaron, representing the particle Li of lowering, subordination, or in Sufi terms, servanthood. So the red, it just shows how many forceful, angry, oppressive words are in this particular section of this particular prayer. Furthermore, the translators of the Aurad have provided a fascinating note regarding the Tuesday morning prayer. This is complimentary prayer to the evening one. I quote, "Two men of awesome mien, dressed in white, appeared to me during a retreat, and they told me to pray with this prayer, which is called the prayer of unveiling, Dua al-Kash. In other manuscripts, they are said to have appeared on the mountain of opening, Jabal al-Fat, in the year 610 Hijri or 1213 of the Common Era. One of them said to me, transmit this from me to all sincere seekers and agreeing aspirants." The note goes on to identify the two as either Moses and Aaron, Aaron being the public speaker, and point out the many Mosaic references in this prayer. Or it may refer to Aaron and John, both associated with the day of Tuesday. Next slide. There he is. The Mosul descents or revelation, Tanazulat. This is a very strange, in fact, occasionally surreal work that details the esoteric meanings of ablution and prayer. Since prayer is connected with the day, and there are five prescribed prayers in a day, Ibn Arabi can assign a prayer to the various prophets connected with one of the five planets, which are observed to retrograde, that is, excluding the sun and the moon. The Isha, or night prayer, is connected with this imam. The fact that it is connected with Tuesday leaves us no doubt that the nameless imam referred to in this section is none other than Aaron. The night prayer is a time of prayer that may extend from dark to dawn, and it is the ideal time for supererogatory prayers and intimate conversation with the beloved. It is not entirely clear to me why Aaron is connected with the night prayer, so I welcome your thoughts on this. But note that Moses is connected with the Zuhr prayer, which is the afternoon prayer, so he is connected with light. There is also much talk of weapons, of steel, red garments, and jihad against enemies of the faith, coupled with verses describing the poet as being lost in passion, hawa again, bewildered, until union comes, and quote, "He became the wearer, and I the garment." I've selected three topics to discuss today. The first I call brothers and others, complementary contradictories. And I begin with a quote from Colonel of the Colonels. The reality in its qualities, in its descent, and in its degrees accepts the opposite, because from its point of view, there is no such thing as opposite. It is my contention that the narratives of Moses and Aaron, Aaron and Moses, should be considered together, read together, studied together, for indeed they are inextricably bound to each other and to us. As complementary contradictories, when joined together, they present to us a picture of a wholeness, Kamal, that reflects the nature of being itself. As the Sheikh writes in the Isra, God has made both of them, Moses and Aaron, equal in light and clarity. The uterine bond and the strength of the bloodline is repeatedly mentioned in various contexts throughout the Sheikh's writings, often alongside the idea of gifts and petitions, Adam's son Seth, for example, Zachariah's and Abraham's prayers for a righteous son. The link will be strong not only through blood and divine gift, but also through belief. The believer, mu'min, is brother of the believer, and their father is belief. The notion of duality runs throughout the saga of the two brothers, their attributes sometimes clearly assigned, but sometimes paradoxically reversed. Furthermore, we may look briefly at their cousin John, far removed in time and place, but somehow relevant to the story. And to top it off, what would the story be without a distorting mirror image of the brothers, a skewed quaternity formed by the addition of the adversaries, Pharaoh and the Samurai? The background of these two brothers, united in leadership of the community, couldn't be more different. Aaron was born before the decree of killing all the male Hebrew children. He was raised in the religion of his tribe within his own family. Moses was raised in the high culture of Egypt as an adopted son of the Pharaoh. He is a hybrid. Moses' destiny was extraordinary from the outset, as we have shown in his chapter of the Fasus. He exceptionally assumes the spirits of all the male children slaughtered by order of Pharaoh, all their powers, potentialities, and destinies. It is not clear whether the brothers had much contact with each other as children, but by the time Moses encounters the burning bush, he is aware that his brother has qualities that he himself does not possess. And so, as the Quranic narrative goes, he seeks to add the prophethood of Aaron to his own. One of the broadest and most salient differences between the two is of such stark contrast that it calls our attention to two divine names or attributes of Jalal, majesty, sometimes connected with justice as well, and Jamal, beauty. Aaron is more closely identified with the merciful mother. Moses, more with the severe father. In truth, the brothers bring together in themselves both of these attributes, but manifest them in different ways. Moses has a manifest or zahiri, Jalal, while being Jamal in a concealed botany sense. The opposite is true of Aaron. Manifestly, he is Jamal, while within he has a strong Jalal character, majesty within beauty. The fact is that both qualities are essential in a leader of a community. There's no question that Moses is quick to judge, prone to impatience. In Moses, we hear the external voice of anger, contention, force, and power. He is always hastening, acting impetuously, istajala, a word whose root is also connected to the calf itself, ijl, a reflection perhaps of Moses' own impatience. His community also seems to reflect his hastiness as they tire of waiting for him and seek to worship a god in form. Moses' rashness and predisposition to wrath are much in evidence. He exhibits the impetuous and severe edge to justice. We see him killing the Egyptian, arguing with God over the command to approach Pharaoh, pulling his brother's beard and breaking the tablets in response to the incident of the calf. Even at the level of their staffs, symbols of authority, his, or possibly Aaron's staff, but under his command, turns into a snake, while Aaron's rod also brings in beautiful bloom. Aaron, on the other hand, is often credited in biblical sources with patience and delay. One interpretive excuse for Aaron's fashioning the calf For in the Bible, he is its maker. Is it Aaron hopes that by gradually rounding up the golden ornaments and slowly molding the bovine form, he can delay the actual worship of the calf until Moses' return? For him, the greatest sin appears to be intracommunal hatred and division. In Jewish sources, he is credited with resolving differences between people, calming the waters of dissension, a perfect mediator of disputes. Aaron, in fact, is loved by his community. Moses, on the other hand, is feared. Interestingly, in the TV series Moses the Lawgiver, starring Burt Lancaster as Moses, Moses conjectures that Aaron's sin was that he loved the people too much, his own sin, that he loved the law over the people. The quality Aaron embodies in the Pasuk is rachamut, a presence of superlative mercy, specifically connected to the mother's womb. It is, in fact, a combinational mercy in many senses. First of all, he's both a mercy in himself and a merciful gift to his brother. His appeal to his brother for mercy in light of the calf incident is graphically seconded by the mercy engraved on the tablets of the law that lie broken at his brother's feet, a double mercy. But most of all, I believe, his rahamut is an embrace of what we might call two aspects of mercy, expressed by the linkage of Rahman to Ar-Rahim, compassion and mercy, which Hertenstein and Veneto allude to in their patterns of contemplation. We have already mentioned the difficulties Moses has with speaking. When told that he must confront Pharaoh, Moses wants to pass the buck to Aaron. He pleads with God, "Oh, my Lord, expand me my breast, ease for me my task, and remove the impediment from my speech so that they may understand what I say." He is identified, however, in Sufi lore as Kalim Allah, the one who talked directly to God. God will speak mouth to mouth in his own form and not by riddles. That's from Numbers in the Bible. And indeed, we find Aaron saying very little in the Quranic narrative as opposed to Moses. But it is implied that Aaron has the common touch, a way of expressing himself at everyone's level. Aaron is constantly associated with all that is low, humble, submissive, weak. He represents the lowliness of animals and of servants, the humility of Mother Earth. Moses, on the other hand, is nearly always associated with highness, with strength, with mountains and fire. His word in the Pasuk is uluwiya, elevation, his divine name, Al-Kawi, powerful. While Pharaoh says, "I am your Lord Most High," it is Moses who is actually Most High. That said, he is called the most humble of men in the Jewish tradition. As the Sheikh writes in The Alchemy of Human Happiness, nobody is ordered to speak with gentleness except one whose strength is greater than that of the one he is sent to, whose power is mightier. We should mention also what at first appears to be a puzzling familial connection with the prophet John, Yahya, who in spiritual ascents through the spheres can sometimes be found with Jesus, and sometimes with Aaron. This is something that the Sheikh asked John about and when he meets him with Jesus in his spiritual ascent recounted in chapter 378 of the Futuhat, since he realizes that there are centuries separating the two prophets. "I asked him, 'Is this your heaven?' He said to me, 'No, I go back and forth between Jesus and Aaron, so sometimes I'm with this one and sometimes with the other.' I asked him, 'Why is Aaron singled out rather than other prophets?' He answered, 'Because of the sanctity of kin relationships, but I'm closer to Jesus than to Aaron.' John explains that Jesus is the son of his aunt Miriam, and that Miriam is Aaron's sister, both in faith and kin relation. This claim is based on a confusion between the names of Aaron's sister Miriam and Miriam, Jesus' mother. Thus the Sheikh objects, 'But Aaron is not her brother, because between the two of them is a long period of time and a whole world.' John then discusses the idea of tribal affinity that carries on through the centuries, an affinity that is much like the notion of heirs of the prophets and the siblinghood of milk. One cannot fail to notice that the antagonists of the two brothers in the narrative that we have mentioned in the narrative we recounted bear striking similarities to the brothers themselves. We cannot fail to notice that there's a certain similarity between the two of them. Pharaoh is a creature in some ways like Moses, a grand, oversized figure of might and power. Many of the strong divine names are given expression in these two somewhat similar human vessels. The difference, however, is that Pharaoh's grandeur is self-proclaimed, while Moses' highness is sheer mercy and gift from God. The Samari, or Samaritan, who only appears in the Quran's narrative, can be seen as a counterpart of Aaron. It may be that he is the echo of another famous Samaritan, Simon Magus, known from the Acts of the Apostles as a convert and rebel, who claimed superior esoteric knowledge and who performed magic based on this knowledge. He usurps Aaron's role as imam, becoming in effect high priest of the community, based on what he assumes to be a divine vision of a calf as one of the angelic bearers of the throne, similar to Ezekiel's vision of the ox figure from the Tetramorph. He has seen, if not Gabriel himself, Gabriel's footprint, and based on his knowledge that Gabriel brings life wherever he treads, he causes the calf to bellow by casting the life-enhancing dust upon it. In this, he shows an ability to work magic in an apparently similar way to Aaron's rod becoming a serpent or a blooming stem of almond blossoms. But the Samari's bag of tricks holds nothing but ruses to seduce the Israelites, while, as we know from the Quran, God is the best trickster. God's trickery is another subject dealt with in this story, but we must leave that aside for now. The next theme we will discuss is Imamiyah. In both the Quranic and biblical sources, Aaron is considered a prophet. But as the Sheikh points out, his level as a prophet is lower than that of Moses. While most prophets experience God's intimate presence in a vision or a dream, God speaks to Moses mouth to mouth. God is present with Moses constantly without any recourse to altered states of consciousness. As for his being an envoy, it is only through his brother's request for aid and God's command to deliver the message to Pharaoh that he becomes an envoy in a very special and limited sense. He forms part of a dual messengerhood, a messengerhood of brothers. He does not become a law-giving envoy. We should note that Aaron, whose word in the Fusus is Imamiyah, is actually never called Imam in the Quran. He is primarily designated as Moses' wazir. The word wazir, usually translated as minister, connects with the underlying meaning of helping, assisting, even strengthening. It is definitely a supporting rather than primary role. It is closely associated with the Arabic word azar, strength, which is what Moses believes Aaron's appointment will glean for him. And give me a minister, wazir, from my family, Aaron, my brother. Add to my strength through him and make him share my strength. The obvious relation between these two Arabic roots continues with the material representation as both Izar and Wizra as loincloth. It is clear that Aaron is to be a covering or protection for Moses. This protection is evident on many levels, but one certainly is that Moses' character, heavy on the Jalal, they may need to be modulated for the people, adapted to their capacity for hearing the message, geared to their different levels of understanding. Otherwise, the message may be deemed too fierce, too extreme. So in this way, Aaron's gentleness and accommodation become Moses' cover, his filter. Ibn Arabi himself gives support to this claim in Kitab al-Isra, when he gets a chance to ask Moses why he asked God for Aaron to help him. He answered, out of mercy for those he addressed, so they would not be annihilated while envisioning the word from his mouth. How could they stand the discourse of the one who addressed him without an intermediary, those who are of dense or simple nature? The root, waw, zay, ra, is also connected with burdens and even sins. So in a way, the wazir assumes a burden and responsibility of office, not unlike a lowly animal supports and often carries the baggage of his superior. Before passing on to a discussion of imamiyah per se, we may ask, what does it mean to be an imam? Is it different from being a khalifa, which is the other word associated with Aaron in the Quran? Moses had charged his brother Aaron, take my place, akhlufni, among my people. Do right and follow not the way of those who do mischief. One could say that the imam, through its Arabic root, stands in front as when leading the ritual prayer, whereas the khalifa is left behind as a functional substitute for the ruler. The Sheikh al-Akbar, however, says that they are the same. Khalifa, often translated as vice-regent, carries meanings of being appointed successor, of substitution, as well as the apparently unrelated idea of differing, being contrary or opposed. Aaron displays both of these aspects since he acts as Moses' substitute in his absence, but also because his approach to leading the community differs from that of his brother. A champion of compromise, it is his greatest fear that he will in some way cause differences to fracture the ummah. The Khalifa loves the people and does not want there to be any division. There is a desire to change the interior hearts of his people towards God and guide them away from being misled. This is from the White Fasus chapter on Lot. The return of Moses and the resultant confrontation with his Khalifa are a vivid display of the clash between their apparently contrary natures. When we turn to the notion of imamate, or as it is sometimes translated, religious leadership, the specific nuances suggested by this Arabic root, Hamza Mim Mim, convey the rather unique relationship Aaron has to this kind of leadership. As we pointed out earlier, the root can mean standing before or in front of, but it's also related to ummah, community, and mother. As James Morris points out in his article, Freedoms and Responsibilities, it suggests a kind of leadership emanating from intimacy, with closeness, with the mother, the womb, the milk brotherhood of shared faith. In short, a leadership of compassion, rahma. Like the mother whose patient role in raising and educating is stressed in the Fasus chapter on Aaron, the imam seems to have an innate sense of what is needed by a particular community at a particular time. The setting up of a religion is the aim, and it is not possible without security, aman. So taking an imam is necessary in every time, zaman. That's from the introduction to the Futuhat. Aaron's is a leadership that takes individual differences into account while encouraging a salutary cohesiveness and preserving the limits set by God. Another aspect of imamiyah consists of what the Sheikh al-Akbar terms the greater and lesser divine stewardship. The lesser consists of the personal imamiyah, the more intimate imamiyah over oneself. One might, however, consider the greater imamiyah, much in the way the greater and the lesser jihad. He says, quote, you should uphold God's limits with regard to yourself, whatever you possess, for you are responsible to God for that. So if you are a ruler, you have been designated for upholding God's limits regarding all he has entrusted to you. For each one of you is a shepherd and responsible for his flock. And the lowest form of right rulership is your governance of your soul and your actions. So uphold God's limits, respecting them until you reach the greater khilafah. For you are God's representative, khalifa, in every situation regarding your own soul and that which is above it. It is highly unusual and often deemed contrary to wisdom to have two leaders concurrently guiding the community. So what of the case of Moses and Aaron? In a sense, we might say that they are not two, but a single leader with two complementary facets. One representing the strength of justice, the other the tenderness of mercy. It is frequently pointed out in both Islamic and Judaic sources that their prophecy is one, and that Aaron's prophecy is included in Moses', perhaps representing the esoteric leadership, much as Ali is sometimes represented in the case of Muhammad, or John in the case of Jesus. As the Quran states, Then we sent Moses and his brother Aaron with signs and clear authority. In a commentary on the biblical Song of Songs, the two brothers and their nurturing guidance of their community are compared to two breasts. These are Moses and Aaron. Just as breasts are the beauty and glory, the harmony, honor, and praise of a woman, so Moses and Aaron were the beauty and glory, the harmony, honor, and praise of Israel. And just as these breasts are full of milk, so Moses and Aaron filled Israel with Torah. It is true that in the episode of the golden calf, there appears to be a difference in focus, Aaron allowing the immanental worship of the real in form versus Moses emphasizing transcendent worship of the one without likeness, while Moses expresses the verticality of a sense necessary to receive face-to-face revelation from the real. Aaron represents the horizontality of conveying the truth of this revelation to the community. They each present an inextricable harmony of guidance and mercy to their people, despite the apparent polarity. In the Jewish tradition, although Aaron is considered a prophet, it is chiefly as a priest, the high priest, in fact, that he is known. He wears special regalia, breastplate containing jewels representing the 12 tribes. The priest has exoteric and esoteric functions. He administers the sacrifice of different classes of animals and accepts the sin offerings of the people. As such, he is connected with blood and fire, the color red, and the expiation of sin. One of his duties is the pronouncement of the most holy and concealed name, which only he had knowledge of, in the Holy of Holies on one day of the year, Yom Kippur. Although the temple is no more, Aaron's descendants, the Kohanim, the Kohens, continue to administer the priestly blessing, also known as the Aaronic benediction. And there is Leonard Limoy as Spock giving the priestly blessing. Our final topic will be the worship of the calf and why is it considered a secret rather than a sin. In the White Vesuz chapter of Moses, it is said that the worship of the calf is a great mystery. The biblical and Quranic versions of the story of the golden calf reach different conclusions about Aaron's responsibility. The Bible clearly puts the blame on Aaron, claiming that he was the conceiver of the plan, the collector of the golden ornaments, and the actual artisan. When Moses returns from his tryst with the Most High, he asks Aaron what he has done. Aaron's answer in Exodus is, "Let my Lord not be enraged. They said to me, 'Make us a god to lead us, for that man, Moses, who brought us from the land of Egypt, we do not know what happened to him.' So I said to them, 'Whoever has gold, rip it off.' They gave it to me, and I hurled it into the fire, and out came this calf." In the Quran, however, it is the Samiri who formulates the plan based on a combination of a vision that may evoke the image of Ezekiel's wheel or that of the four angelic bearers of the throne and the life-giving dust of Gabriel's footprint. Aaron merely acquiesces out of fear of dividing the community. The secret of the calf may be that the people were not entirely wrong. It may even be said that Aaron didn't go far enough and should have allowed the worship of the calf without resistance. Did he not realize that the real is the only being whose places of manifestation are infinite? Even so-called idols are places of manifestation. To counteract the inevitable backlash that such a statement could, and certainly did, elicit, Ibn Arabi insists on citing the Quranic dictum that your Lord has decreed that you should worship none but him. The goal of the worship of any worshiper is in fact nothing other than God. Nothing, if it is not God, is worship for itself. The error of the associators, the mushrik, is just that of engaging in a form of worship that is not prescribed by God. This is where education and guidance brought by the envoy come in. The envoy delivers a message to his particular community for that particular time. It is his guidance that the sheikh links to clear expression, bayan. It is also called a light in the heart of the one who is guided to the real. Furthermore, Moses is not free from blame in this incident. Acting with his usual haste and anger, he appears to break the fraternal bond in addition to the tablets of the law. It is only when he focuses on the words written here, mercy and guidance, that he understands the attitude he should have taken toward his brother and the community at large. He asks God for forgiveness, and he is forgiven. As Wersavi explains in the Kernel of the Kernels, and now we have this, your Lord's decree is that you do not worship any but him. In love and praise and in exaltation, you should know no other than him, see no other than him, and be a servant to no other than him. Even the worship of an idol results in the worship of God, because the existence of the idol is also of God. The error of the people lies in a limited and restricted worship, as opposed to seeing divinity both in everything, everywhere, as well as transcendent from it. We recall the Sheikh's words in the Fasus chapter on Noah, a companion chapter to this one in many ways. In every object of worship, there is a reflection of the reality, whether it be recognized or not. Indeed, in every object of worship, it is in truth God who is worshipped. What the people who worshipped the calf sought to do was not per se to worship the idol in itself. They were well aware that the calf wasn't even a real calf, but a form made out of mineral elements. What they would say to their accusers is that they don't worship the thing in itself, but only, quote, that they might bring us nearer to God. As the Sheikh writes in his commentary on poem 12 of the Tarjuman al-Ashwaq, those who worship God in the sun behold a sun, and those who worship him in living things see a living thing, and those who worship him in inanimate objects see an inanimate object, and those who worship him as a being unique and unparalleled see that which has no like. Every place is a tajalli, and the tajalliyat are infinite, created anew in every instant. It is Abu Bakr seeing God before everything. The impulse to worship appears to be innate in creation. Immersed in a dazzling display of multiplicity, the opportunities to exalt certain forms and beliefs over others is inevitable. But this is only one half of the equation. The intangible, ineffable, transcendent source, the ungraspable from a position of duality. We can only perceive what is imminent and acknowledge that the divine flows through it. This is the first step, the recognition and confirmation that we and everything within our grasp, from the world of witnessing to the higher worlds of spiritual forms and meanings, are theaters of manifestation for an indivisible, singular reality. As we noted when discussing the themes of various works of the Sheikh, there is one theme that occupies the Fasus's chapter on Aaron that we want to discuss here, and that is the theme of Hawa. And I recommend Volant Rauf's extract of a letter 32, Passion, for a beautiful synopsis of this topic. Hawa generally gets a bad rap as an inferior type of love, a kind of animal or natural passion. Definitions of Hawa and its cognates include falling, as in falling in love, dropping down, plunging into an abyss or chasm, erroneous opinions, amorous inclinations of the heart. Ibn Arabi often mentions it in connection with Surat al-Najm, the surah of the star, which begins with the oath, by the star as it falls, Hawa. Hawa is connected with desire, usually of a lower sort, specific to one's own wants and extremely volatile. Sometimes it is translated as whim or caprice. The Prophet Muhammad is cautioned in the Quran, do not follow the desires, ahwa, of those who do not know. And David is told not to rule with hawa, advice which sometimes he does not follow. In chapter 559 of the Futuhat, Ibn Arabi vividly describes it as leading one off the legitimate way, swerving wildly. Intellect has no foothold there. One might conjecture correctly that hawa is dangerous and that it should be extirpated from the soul at all costs. But this is not possible. As Ibn Arabi says in chapter 178 of the Futuhat, God knows that it is impossible to uproot passion, and he does not ask us to do the impossible. Hawa never ceases. It is part of our very fabric of being. In fact, the Sheikh al-Akbar makes the astounding claim in more than one place that what we worship when we worship is nothing other than Hawa. Hawa is our God, and that Hawa worships Hawa, and that if we do not worship God with Hawa, we are not worshiping God at all. There's no doubt that what we worship passionately in form, be it golden calves or golden coins, can lead to an abysmal fall. The Sheikh writes, Hawa is unfettered, roaming freely. It leads whoever follows it astray from the path of God. But he does not stop there. He continues, but not from God, since it flows through the whole of God's dominion, Malakut. It is in God's hand. And he says later, there is nothing but Hawa's decree and its ruling. The goal then appears to be seeking to align our Hawa with that of the real, to love God with all our hearts, with all our souls, with all our strength. I can think of no better way to end this all too brief discussion of Hawa, as well to this overlong presentation, with this beautiful passage from the Kernel of the Kernels, since it expresses so beautifully the nature of Hawa, here translated as caprice, that pervades all of creation. It's too long to put on the screen, so I'm just going to read it. It is true that according to the rule that, quote, he is at every moment in a different configuration, there are states and degrees, but he shows in every wink a caprice, and in every caprice a scent, and in every scent a beauty, and in every beauty a love, and in every love a wink, and in every wink caprice, and in every caprice a scent, and in every scent a kind of recommencement. Because of this, the people who are addicted to love and are in lament fall into different states. Sometimes they become the place of manifestation for the qualities of majesty, jalal, and constriction, qabd, or they are the place of manifestation of expansion, bast, and pleasure. They dive into pleasure and find joy. Sometimes they fall into caprice and sometimes into beseeching. These qualities take on different attitudes in the eyes of love, but the lover does not repudiate any of these. If this is so, how then is the Gnostic going to allow himself to be subject to one form or another? The beloved that the lover is in love with, whatever quality he adorns himself with, whatever garment he dresses himself in, never gets confused and does not get attached to any single face. Though he himself sees the beauty from every face, he excuses those who get tied up with one of his faces. His circle is large. Those who get tied up with one aspect or another, he says, that is also one of his affairs, and accepts it as a thing necessitated by one of the divine names. In fact, God himself says, there is not one thing alive on earth that God does not hold by his forelock, and let everyone know for sure that my Lord is on a straight path. Thank you.